Yes.
Yeah.
Could have been lying over there.
Yeah, okay. Well, I was asked to come and say something about the mind in the context of yoga meditation like that. And I thought I'd begin by reading a couple of verses from Bhagavad Gita. Bhagavad Gita as it is, translation and commentary by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. Got a picture of Prabhupada here?
No.
Oh, okay. Right, there he is in the corner. I actually met him, you know, first, 1972. I was a student in university in Auckland, New Zealand, April 1972. So that's sure, what is that? Almost 44 years ago. Where were you 44 years ago? Well, you know, if you've been coming along to these sessions, you probably know the idea in the yoga tradition, the meditation tradition, Vedic tradition, the idea would be that 44 years ago, I think every one of you, except me, you would have all been in your previous lifetimes. Okay. Anyway, we're not going to go into that sort of thing so much right now. But we'll just consider a few things about the mind. And I'm going to read a couple of verses here from Bhagavad Gita. Chapter 3, which is titled Karma Yoga. And I think I'll read verse 42 and 43 and then say a few words for just a little while. And then if any of you got any questions, comments, anything you'd like to bring up, there'll be time for that. And you know what they told me? You know what they told me? I'll tell you what they told me. They told me the students in Vince are very intelligent. Yeah. That's what they said. It was him too. and some others. They told me the students here in Vince are very intelligent, very thoughtful, and have many questions, you know, like to sort of delve more deeply into these things. So as we go on, just consider if anything comes to mind. And then you can ask some questions and or if you prefer, you know, you can always put your hand up, that's fine. But you can also, if you want, write your question down. If you would prefer to be anonymous, or if you just prefer to do it that way. Okay, so here we go. Bhagavad Gita, chapter 3, Karma Yoga, verse 42 and 43. So this is now, I'll just read the Sanskrit, the original language of the text. Indriyani param yahur, indriyebhya param mana, manasas tu para buddhir, yo buddhe paratas tu sa. Just listen to this. It's a slightly subtle idea. The working senses, you know, sight, hearing, touch, etc. The working senses are superior to dull matter. Mind is higher than the senses. Intelligence is still higher than the mind. And the soul is even higher than the intelligence. Interesting. Okay, and now this is now verse 43. Evam buddhe param buddhva samstabhyat manam atmana jahishatrum mahabaho kamarupam durasadam. Thus, knowing oneself to be transcendental to the material senses, mind and intelligence. O Arjuna, that's who Krishna is speaking to, someone called Arjuna. One should steady the mind by deliberate spiritual intelligence, Krishna consciousness, and thus by spiritual strength conquer this insatiable enemy known as lust. I hope that wasn't an overload of information, ideas, concepts you may not be so familiar with. But the basic idea to start off with, what Krishna is saying is that first of all, there's the body, means just flesh and blood and bones and so on. And then working through the body, using the body sort of as a medium, are the senses. Like you're all sitting here, and every one of you is looking at me with your sense of sight. Everyone is listening. So the senses sort of illuminate the body, you could say. Because, you know, when the body is dead, the senses are no longer functioning. No more perception of anything. So first of all, there's the body, which is just dull matter. You know, when I was at school, I started school 1956. And we were told in those days, our bodies were, I think, if I remember correctly, 70% water. Is it the same nowadays? Or did the water level rise? So it's just water. It's just ordinary water. And then the bones are calcium, of course, and there are various other ingredients which the body is made of. So the body is just matter, but it's illuminated by the senses of sight, of hearing, of smell, of touch, of taste. And then what Krishna said in the first of these verses is that then above the senses is the mind, and above the mind is the intelligence, and above your intelligence is you. The soul, you know, in sort of technical language, the soul, but the person, the actual entity, who, at least according to the science of yoga and meditation, we are all eternal souls, we are all eternal spiritual persons. Higher than these bodies, but we're kind of sort of trapped linked or just caught up in these bodies? Yeah, we're caught up in these bodies. So the eternal conscious person is higher than the intelligence, like sometimes we even say, my intelligence, my mind. In other words, there's me and my mind and my clothes and my book. And look, I got a, my garland. Isn't it a nice one? It's mine. My garland and my mind, my senses, my intelligence, my body, and then there's me. I don't want to sort of complicate things too much, but this is the hierarchy, you could say, as presented in Bhagavad Gita, which is the prime book of the philosophy of yoga. First there's me, the soul, then my intelligence, my mind, my senses, my body. It's a hierarchy. And me, I am meant to use my intelligence constructively in useful, productive ways to benefit me. And the intelligence is then meant to direct the mind. The mind, through the mind, the intelligence directs the senses. Do this, say that, and, you know, look at this and listen to that. The senses are meant to be directed intelligently via the mind, and then the body is meant to function in those ways and actually do useful things. But interesting point, very interesting point, is that generally in everyday life, the hierarchy is kind of upside down. Yeah, you know, you have a body, and you may have a male body, you may have a female body, or someone has a big body, a small body, or even someone may have the body of an animal. Again, we're not going to go into too many of these other areas, although they're worthy of attention. But and then, depending on your body, your senses will function. Meaning, just as an example, how about a little more dramatic example? Pigs are attracted to eating the sense of taste. Because of the body, the sense of taste is attracted to eating, you know, like dirty things, like sewerage even. Because of the nature of the body, the senses are working differently. Or, you know, classically, of course, we hear it's different sometimes or however often nowadays. If you have a male body, then you would be attracted to female bodies and vice versa. So there's meant to be this hierarchy then, where you are utilizing your intelligence, which is guiding the mind to engage the senses in different ways, and then the body is meant to act. But nowadays, the body, the senses, tend to dictate. Like, take a very simple little thing, inanimate thing, like a cigarette. So the cigarette is just an inanimate little object, but the cigarette dictates to a person who's a cigarette fan or addict. The cigarette dictates. The senses say, yeah, we want that. And the senses are sending impulses to the mind. The mind is sort of the center, and the impulses, stimuli, are coming from the senses, which are perceiving the world through the body. So in this case, the little cigarette, you know, look at it, it's only that big, and it's just dead matter. But it is, in effect, dictating to the senses, which tell the mind, wow, this looks good. And the mind tells the intelligence, we must make a plan to get this. And your intelligence tells you, you need this. And so you are just dragged along by the force of the senses, being controlled even by the sense objects. Do you get the idea? It's a very interesting thought. And we are meant to like reassert ourselves, you know, turn the hierarchy the right way up again. And a very important part, like really essential part of that, is to focus the mind. Because the mind is, it's right in the center of the whole thing. We're meant, even you could say, to control the mind. And when, if the mind is receiving, you know, like say for example, you are meant to be studying for an exam. What are you studying?
Medicine.
Medicine. Okay. You're meant to be studying for an exam, but then your friend, someone tells you, hey, there's going to be a party, or there's going to be a movie, there's going to be a concert with your favorite, whoever your favorite is. And then your mind says, wow, I got to go and, you know, go to the concert, and you neglect your study. And then the exam is tomorrow, and you may fail. Did you ever fail? Anyway, okay. You ever failed something? You know what it feels like. And the more you fail, the worse it feels. So that the mind can be like that. Due to some sensory attraction to go and listen to the music, then the mind is stimulated, and your intelligent plan, for example, to study for your exams, gets kind of put aside or thrown aside because your senses dictated to your mind and your mind said, right, that's what we want to do because it feels good. The thing about the mind is, the mind doesn't have any intelligence. The intelligence has the intelligence. In the science of yoga, the philosophy of yoga, we distinguish between the mind and the intelligence. We don't just sort of mix them up together and say, you know, they're just parts of the psychology of the person. But we actually separate them. So the intelligence is meant to control the mind and direct the mind, which should then direct the senses. Do this, do that, and don't do something else, right? In constructive ways. So, to control the mind, so it's not so, you could say, just susceptible to the messages, the promptings coming from the senses. That's one of the most important parts of yoga. And let's face it, folks, that's one of the most important parts of doing something useful with your life. Yeah. Because, you know, if you take an extreme case, someone who's like an alcoholic, in that they're attached to the sensory experience of it all. And the mind is just fascinated with it, even though it's obviously destroying their lives. You know, when I was at university in the 1970s in Auckland, New Zealand, I was studying philosophy. Any of you studying philosophy? Oh, you are? Okay, fair enough. You heard of the British philosopher of about 120 years ago or something, Bertrand Russell? Bertrand Russell. He was very famous, and I studied him when I was at university studying philosophy. So Bertrand Russell, he was very brilliant, like very sharp, very clever. Wow, amazing. But he had a very interesting problem. And he was like a public character. He was a famous man. He wasn't just some obscure academic. He was a popular personality in the culture of the day. Well-known person. But he had a problem. And his problem was, he was addicted to cigarettes. He had a serious problem. And he was regularly trying to give up smoking. And giving it up. And then taking it up again. And then giving it up. And taking it up again. And one time he was interviewed. And he was famous for having this problem. He was interviewed. The interviewer was, you know, kind of humorous fellow, and said, "Mr. Russell, we hear that, you know, you've smoked a lot in your day. Have you got any advice for our readers or listeners or whatever who may be trying to give up smoking?" And Bertrand Russell, he said, "Yeah, sure. Giving up smoking, no problem." He said, "Giving up smoking is easy. I've done it many times." Did you get that one? I thought it was very funny. Kind of British humor, maybe. So he's such a brilliant man. You know, if you have any doubts about it, you should read he wrote an essay with respect. It's called "Why I Am Not a Christian." It's a famous essay by Bertrand Russell. You can look it up on Google. And you read that. Wow. You know, he's really clever. He's just so clever. It's amazing. So he's so brilliant. But he can't control his senses. And he knew it. And he knew it was a problem. And he was trying and struggling and failing because his senses were just overpowering his mind and overpowering his intelligence. And he's just getting dragged into this, like, on a daily basis, you could say. So in yoga, in meditation, very important part of it, and if you can succeed in it, you feel the benefits so much, is controlling the mind and getting the mind to focus its attention, its energy, because the mind is powerful. You know, it's so powerful it can overpower the intelligence if you give it a chance. But when you focus the mind, and then the mind focuses the senses positively in constructive, productive ways, wow, you can really do something. You can, you know, your whole life can just transform literally overnight, or even quicker than overnight, practically on the spot. But the thing is, how are we going to do that? How are we going to do that? I mean, you'll note I'm not taking the sort of Freudian approach here, analytical psychology, clinical psychology. It's a more sort of general oversight, general type of perspective here. Yeah, how to control the mind and then focus it and then via it engage the senses in useful activity. Well, this is where yoga and meditation comes in. It really does. And, you know, like what you were doing when I walked in, you were singing the mantra. There, the Hare Krishna mantra. I imagine you're all familiar with it, I suppose. Mantra. It's a Sanskrit word. I read those two verses. The original language is Sanskrit. Very ancient language. And in Sanskrit, mantra, it is a compound word. To get grammatical about it, it's two words compounded, man and tra. Man means the mind, and tra means to deliver. So mantra, you know, it's a very simple term, you could say. It means sound vibration which delivers the mind from its absorption, its entanglement on the lower sensory level, and even ultimately just the worldly level, what's going on in the world, the politics, the economics, you know, the ANC, the DA, has the rand lost value altogether? And, you know, all these types of questions, interesting questions. So, mantra is sound vibration which delivers the mind from those lower things which otherwise preoccupy us, and or sometimes just sort of drag our attention away into something, sometimes, at least sometimes, which is counterproductive to what you're actually trying to do. So, you know, we recommend chanting mantra to control the mind and focus the mind. We recommend it for everyone, business people, politicians. I many years ago, it was, sure. It was about a year after Nelson Mandela got out of prison. What was that? Anyway, whenever it was. He visited our main temple in Durban, Nelson Mandela, and I showed him around. So we were sitting in the main room and talking a bit about these things. And there was a statue of Prabhupada, the picture in the corner there, a statue just facing us on the other side of that main temple hall. And Mr. Mandela asked me, how did he do it? Means, you know, spread this whole tradition around the world in a relatively short period of time. I mean, actually, well, interestingly enough, this year we are celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Hare Krishna movement coming out of India and coming around the world. So he asked, how did he do it, Mr. Mandela? And so we discussed that. And I brought up about the mantra. And would you believe, he already knew the mantra. He already knew it. Because he had been on Robben Island with some of his ANC colleagues. And there was one of them in particular. His name is Logi Naidu. And he's still active. He's the speaker in the KwaZulu-Natal parliament, whatever they have, Logi Naidu. And he was like a bit of a Hare Krishna devotee. Not too much, but to some degree. And when they all got locked up, Logi Naidu, they told him, you can have one book. And he chose Bhagavad Gita. And he and Nelson Mandela and the others, they used to discuss these things quite often. So anyway, Nelson Mandela said, yeah, you know, I've heard that Hare Krishna mantra. It's very powerful. And, you know, Nelson Mandela or not, it's a fact, it's very powerful. Spiritual sound vibration, which delivers the mind, frees the mind from anxieties. Any of you ever experienced anxiety? She says she has. You can ask her if you want to know. Excuse me. Anyway, we've all experienced anxiety. But mantra, and you know, when you get into anxiety, if you really get into serious anxiety, then you feel it in your body. Like your stomach muscles may sort of contract and... the face is the index of the mind, they say sometimes. And sometimes you look at a person and you see this person's in anxiety. Because even though the anxiety is internal, it's in the mind, but the mind is connected with the senses and the body. It's just a very simple, practical thing. Yeah, so... And that means when you get into anxiety, a lot of your mental energy is just becoming sort of possessed by the state of the mind. And therefore your mental energy, your mental strength being kind of caught up in that anxiety, you cannot use it productively. And focus it, because it's already caught up there. So therefore, mantra is very useful for everybody, and including students. You know, I can tell you, if you chant the mantra regularly, you don't have to chant it all day, but just regularly for a while, every day, I can, you know, I can't give you perhaps a written guarantee, but I can assure you, if you do that, you will be able then to focus your mind as you want it to focus more. And in that way, you will be more successful. You'll be more able to apply yourself in your studies, and you'll be more successful. Give it a try. I'll come back in a few months, check how you're doing, and if you really try, and if it doesn't work, I'll give you your money back. But we don't charge any money, so. But no, seriously. Otherwise, you know, the mind, the senses, are sending stimuli in, some sound vibration, something you see, something you feel, taste, all these types of sensory stimuli are coming into the mind. And the mind, as we said, the mind has no intelligence. All the mind knows, you know what the mind knows? All the mind knows is what it thinks will make it feel the best. Yeah. But the intelligence, you know, what may make you feel good on that level may not always be the best thing for you. Yeah. Like cigarettes, like, you know, something more serious like opiates. And, you know, they may make you feel exceptionally good, like you can't believe. But your life will be destroyed. And you'll be destroyed. Oh, okay. Okay, so to focus the mind then, very important. Get your mind to become a little independent. Woman's independence, right? Men's independence too. We need to become independent of the senses. Yeah. And just being dictated to by the senses, so that we can then focus our lives intelligently in ways which will help us. So please chant the mantra regularly. Give it a try. Are any of you chanting regularly, like on a daily basis? A few of you? Good. Okay, good. And those of you who are not, okay, fine. But give it a try, why not? Give it a try, see what happens. There's nothing to lose. There's really nothing to lose. And like I said, basically I guarantee that you will become more, you could say, a master of your destiny than previously when you were just sort of, you know, being dictated to by your senses more, and the mind was just going this way and that, depending on what feelings were coming. So there you go, students. Hare Krishna. Now, I saw someone with the questions sheet.
Some verbal ones, and then you move around some
of us. Okay, yeah, you got a question, write it down. Otherwise, if you're bold enough, feel free. Ask a question, yes.
Almost a spiritual thing? I don't But I heard that in the beginning you said something about lust is something you need to escape. And I was wondering whether lust and desire are the same thing or are they different things, and how can we harness desire as something?
Okay. Good, good. That's a good one. Right, yeah. You know, lust is a type of desire. There are many different types of desires. And, you know, like so many things, they are useful, productive desires, like to become a doctor and help people. That's good. But then they are, you know, useless or even like detrimental desires of different types, like to commit suicide. It's a detrimental type of desire. Or, you know, whatever, to go and join ISIS. I would say that's a very detrimental type of desire. Not recommended. But many people, or some people, they desire it. You know, the thing is, this could easily lead us into a little different, or at least a little deeper area of these concepts than what we've been talking about. But the thing is that ultimately desire could or can be seen as being spiritual, or at least having spiritual roots, because desire is a symptom of your being a person. Yeah, and not just like a thing, like this chair. It's just a thing. It's not a person. It has no personality. It has no desires. So in that sense, desire is like a symptom of the soul. But desire, you know, it depends how you direct your desires, what desires you develop, cultivate. If you become sort of a slave of sensual desires and become addicted to, you know, whatever, some form of intoxication. I was reading, not really, I just saw a headline on CNN, would you believe, about a week ago, someone was saying he was a porn addict and that he found it very detrimental. You can probably look it up on CNN, it may still be there. So it's a form of desire, or, you know, desiring money to the point that you just become a slave and you just work like a dog, or, you know, dogs sleep a lot, so you'd be working like worse than a dog. Yeah. Someone like Napoleon, you know, Napoleon Bonaparte, his desire for power was so great, he basically never slept. He basically stopped sleeping because he was just so much, you know, going from one battlefield to another and one political situation to another, and because of his desire. And, you know, in the end, because of his desire, so many people were killed. So many. Hundreds of thousands or millions died. And he ended up just exiled on some island in the Mediterranean, I forget the name. So what was the use? What was the use? So desire has to be directed intelligently. But as Krishna said here, let me just read it again. Thus, knowing yourself to be transcendental means above, on a higher level than the senses, the mind, and the intelligence, then you should steady the mind by spiritual intelligence. And then you can conquer lust, or you can control your desires and desire the right things and follow through on your desires so you achieve them, rather than just desiring and desiring, and maybe you just, the best you can do is daydream about your desires. Daydream about becoming the richest doctor in the world. So yeah, again, we're coming back to the mantra, helping the mind, strengthening the mind, situating, getting the intelligence stronger so it can direct the mind and not be dictated to by the mind. How does that sound? Interesting. Who's next? Yes, sir.
How does yoga help to steady the mind?
Okay. See, yoga, you know, I think when you use the word yoga, you are referring to the physical exercises. Yoga, there are many forms of yoga. There's Hatha yoga, is the type of yoga which involves training the body to, you could say, harmonize the body with nature and God. Then the meditation is also a form of yoga. It's called in Sanskrit dhyana yoga. And then cultivating spiritual knowledge is another form of yoga. It's called jnana with a G-Y. Jnana means knowledge. So through Hatha Yoga, and the term yoga itself, I don't know if he told you yet, if you translate it into English, the meaning of the word yoga is to link with God. This is what the word means. So Hatha Yoga means that through physical exercises of the body, you come in, your body comes into greater harmony with God. Then the meditation, like chanting the mantra, mantras, there are many mantras, although this is the main one, that's working on the mind, bringing the mind into harmony with God. And like studying this is Bhagavad Gita and similar literatures, the traditional literatures of the tradition, then they bring your intelligence in harmony with God. So you see, yoga is bringing, different yogas are bringing different parts of your system, of your being, more into harmony with God. And ultimately, well, this is the Bhakti Yoga Society, BYS, Bhakti Yoga Society. So bhakti means to serve God. It's just one word, bhakti. To translate it, you know, accurately, it's almost a sentence. To serve God in a mood of devotion or love. So bhakti yoga is a form of yoga which engages all aspects of one's being in harmony with God, in relation with God. So that's the idea, yeah. So yoga helps the mind by, you know, like if your body is sick, if you get really sick, then your mind can't function so well, because body and mind, they're linked together in many ways. Yeah, so when your body is functioning and is very much in harmony with nature, the, you know, like the environment and God, then it makes it easier. Well, you're just sort of, on a physical level, you're more in tune with God. Because it doesn't, you know, that the physical exercises are not really so much engaging your mind, then you may not realize, understand it so clearly, because it's just physical. But the chanting of mantra, the dhyana yoga, or the chanting of the mantras along with the exercises, you know, you'll really feel a greater feeling of being more in harmony with nature, a much greater feeling of peace, satisfaction in natural ways, like that. Is that okay? Yes.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
I don't know if this question is suitable for this, but I just want to know about the trance.
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
And if that trance, I know it's under meditation, if one meditates. I don't know if I'm right or wrong, but how is that equal to uncontrollable vibration of our body?
Okay, depends what you mean by trance.
Yes.
If you mean like the Hanuman trances and Kali trances people get in Kavadi, if you mean like that, it's another thing. But if you mean trance, as it's described in Bhagavad Gita, as a very pure spiritual experience of communion with God, It means a very advanced state of spiritual cultivation in which ultimately one will not necessarily be sort of, you know, like that, but one will be living a life, means acting and conducting one's life in a state of trance, meaning in a state of full consciousness of God, not a state of trance like, you know, sort of catatonic or something like that, but just absorbed in relation with God, in communion with God, but while performing the activities of life, yeah, being fully absorbed without, you know, deviation or distraction. So this is trance in the spiritual sense of the, you know, traditional practice of yoga and meditation. You know, with all due respect, the Kali trances and Durga and, you know, Hanuman trances popular down in Durban, you know, it's really something else, and you can see it's something else because generally the people who go into those trances, when they come out, they go back to being the same sort of person they were before. You know, they just go back to the same old way of life. In other words, they did not change substantially. It was just a temporary experience. Even I've seen, you know, at the fire walking, and I've seen at Kavadi, they finish, you know, they're in some sort of trance or other, they come out and they start smoking cigarettes. So you see, it's like, it's kind of a very mixed up thing. It's a special feature of South African Hinduism or Tamilism. You don't really find it in India.
Yeah.
You don't really find it. Somehow it's popular here. But real, you know, absorption spiritually to the point that one is in trance, not in that sort of, you know, robotic sense, but in the sense of being completely divorced and totally independent of worldly things and absorbed in God consciousness like that type of trance. It develops naturally and step by step through following the process of Krishna consciousness, actually. Is that okay? TK. What's your name?
Nikita.
Hare Krishna, Nikita. And let me just do a time check. What should we do? Oh, snack. Okay, look, I got a question here. Let me just take this question. What is the Bhakti Yoga's belief in terms of destiny, in terms of the will of the person as opposed to that of the divine? In some religions, there's usually seen to be a clash between an individual's will and that of God. Is there a belief of a calling in Bhakti Yoga? You know, I don't know who wrote it, and you know, I don't need to know. I mean, you could identify yourself if you like, but I leave it up to you. But you've actually brought up a few subjects here. Destiny, the will of a person, God's will, and a belief of a calling. These are, I think, five fairly important, you know, and slightly deep subjects. Destiny. Here's a simple answer to the idea of destiny. You know, that someone is just, you know, sort of, they're heading into a certain type of future. Basically, the idea of destiny in terms of, you know, the yoga tradition, meditation tradition, is this: that in our past lifetimes, you know, you were in your previous lifetime when I was at school in 1956. So, in our previous lifetimes, we did so many things. And not just one lifetime either, but many. And everything you do has its consequences. What goes around comes around. Yeah. So destiny in that sense means that because you acted in certain ways in the past, certain things will come to you. And then how you react to those things means you are creating your next destiny. Yeah. Like, according to your destiny, your karma. Karma is the term. Karma means action and reaction as one unit. Action and reaction, two things, but they're one. They're two parts of one thing. Like a coin has a head side, tail side, and, you know, when you've got the coin, you've got both heads and tail sides, and you can't take one or the other. So, by your karma, because of your previous activities, for argument's sake, you are to become rich, and you become rich. But when you become rich, well, you can use that money in this way or that or the other. There's so many. You know, you could use your money to help other people. You could use your money to promote yoga. You could use your money to finance revolution. Some people are doing that. You know, I read, if you don't mind me taking a minute or two, I read about it a couple of years ago, actually, on CNN. So it must be true. That was just a little joke. Anyway, I read about a man. He won in a lottery $133 million. Yeah, $133 million. And he was just an ordinary man working in a factory, like working class, you could say. And now he's like, he's really wealthy. So he gave up work. Life became an endless holiday. But because he's, you know, he's kind of like a simple guy, he got into bad company. And he didn't really understand what was happening, but he just got mixed up with bad people. And one day he was with his bad friends and they just were drinking like mad. And a fight developed and he killed one of his friends. And the police got him. And in CNN, what I read was his wife, the man's wife, was saying, you know, he got sentenced, I don't know if to death or to life in jail, but some really serious prison sentence. And his wife was interviewed, and his wife said, I wish he had never won that money. I wish he was just working in the factory as he had been before. So, you know, due to karma, a windfall just comes. Wow, look at that. Some people would say, what luck. We would say, there is no such thing as luck. It doesn't exist. What exists is the reactions to previous activities. Yeah. So that's something about destiny, and you know, free, and then free will. You mentioned here, there's a clash between an individual's will and that of God. Yeah, our will is displayed in that, you know, we get put in a situation, and then we choose to go this way or that way or whatever way. That's our free will. And we should try to understand the will of God, at least in a very broad sense. The will of God is that we should use our skills, abilities, and everything in His service, for His pleasure, to help Him and to help people come closer to Him. And if we use our will in that way, then that's a good use of our free will. But if we use our will, you know, like the guy who won the lottery, in some way like that, then that's a real misuse of free will. So thank you very much, students, for your time and attention. All the best with your studies. And I'll check back with you later in the year and see how you're doing with your chanting. Hare Krishna.
So, thank you very much to all of you, and a special thanks to Sonny Bhakti Chaitanya Swami for coming and sharing.